to eventually show it to the public. Thank you very much, and to you.
Yes, Ed.
Want me to address this, or is it off out of scope?
No, please feel free.
The Russian S-400, or Buk-PUK, is a very sophisticated anti-aircraft system that became world famous when the Russians in 2014 used one to commit a war crime of shooting down an airliner. And there's been a lot of talk about it, but I know something about that line of work, and I will tell you, that is a war crime. Period. End of discussion for Beijing. But in any event, it is a state-of-the-art anti-aircraft system. And if they're taking something that's so dedicated, so focused on anti-aircraft... Now, by the way, one reason why it's such a big deal is because both Russia and Ukraine have been unable to attain air superiority because both sides have these very effective anti-aircraft missile systems. So that's why being able to take out an anti-aircraft missile system would have a tremendous payback, so they spend a lot of effort on it. So there's a whole lot of stuff to that, but here's my point. To convert an S-400 system from ground to air to ground, you should take something that's tweaked to perfection for one function, and that can do something absolutely different. That's not a tweak. To do that is basically a virtual redesign. And if they're using it for that purpose, that sounds to me more like an act of desperation than anything else, because they have perfectly good ground-to-ground systems, and that's telling me that they're taking... Currently, they have more anti-aircraft systems than they need, and they can convert them to ground-to-ground, but they're not going to be anywhere near as good as a dedicated ground-to-ground system, right?
AC2GS, let me check that I have it. Yeah, okay. I agree with you, Ed. I think they're having a lot of moments of quiet desperation. I think they're running out of state-of-the-art supplies. They're dipping into their ancient tanks. They're dipping into all kinds of old crap that's been rusting in open fields for decades. And I assume that they feel that they don't have enough ground-to-ground weapons that they need to kind of, force the air-to-ground, ground-to-air, into doing another service poorly. I think they're desperate. The only thing that they have a good supply of is, unfortunately, human beings that they keep throwing against the wall and getting killed.
That's another subject.
Yeah, and to a degree, it's kind of an internal war crime. I mean, take a number. The entire philosophy of Russian warfare tends to be kind of onerous. It leans heavy on the sheer terror and the sheer death.
Okay. Well, ever since the dawn of time, war has had that element, the cannon fodder, generically and specifically. But after World War I, I think the world decided that we could do better than this, and they tried to do that. And as horrible in so many ways as World War II was, they really tried to figure out ways around that, absolute cannon fodder, just throwing bodies against the enemy. And now, Russia is going back to something that we had, as a worldwide society, had rejected it decades and decades ago.
To a degree, I agree with you. I think throwing people into a mess was actually useful before the modern weapons that were developed prior to World War I. With the development of these weapons of somewhat mass destruction, it became a bloodbath, and everyone, almost everyone, sort of decided to try and find more clever ways of not getting all of your civilians, citizens killed. Russia, I don't think, ever got the memo. I think they sort of used the same thing in Stalingrad, and yeah, ultimately it worked for them. They probably kind of pulled the same stuff in Afghanistan. So I don't think they got the telegram back after World War I.
USL, old man.
Yes, indeed. It's very sad. You know, I don't blame, for the most part, the Russian people. They're just following orders, although that was the line that they used in World War II with the Nazis. But I don't know. It's an awful situation. I wish it would disappear and the Ukrainians could recover their country and get some of Russia's wealth to build it back up. And maybe Putin could follow that guy from Wagna and fall out of a plane.
Nobody fell out of a plane.
Well, it didn't fall out of a plane, but the plane fell out of the sky. And there are questions. You might have an opinion of whether it was ground to air or whether it was a bomb that was placed on the plane.
Totally academic, of no real world difference.
If you were. When the war started at 24th of February of last year, Russia had about 15-1 more strong armory than Ukraine, but they were given just a few weeks before that hand-holded rocket launchers by Americans, and they were able to stop with that the invasion that was already approaching Kiev, which is the capital of Ukraine. And that was so strong message to the world that now Ukraine is about to have a number of their pilots to be trained for F-16, and they expected total about 126 F-16s to be given, where three European countries decided to already, they asked United States for approval, and they decided to give their own stack of, if I can call it stack, of F-16, which makes available till the end of the year at least 20 to 30 of them on the Ukrainian ground, let me drop. The group of Ukrainians, including mechanics and the land crew, that is maintaining the F-16, was sent for training, if I can call it training, right? Now, as far as reprogramming a ground to air to ground to ground, they first tried that with S-200, which is very old one from 60s. Then they tried with S-300. And now they do it with S-400, which is actually telling that they are in desperacy right now. Most of their armory is not existing anymore. Ukrainians estimate about 267,000 of Russian eliminated from the field, if I can use this word. And Russian decided to reconserve, deconserve, how to use the proper word, take it out of storage. Tanks from 1950s. Yes, that's not a joke, 1950s. They don't have tanks anymore. The most modern one, T-72, is present there in few pieces only. Wagner group of private mercenary had three of them, and now what they do is they take those 1950s and some of them they put the explosive inside. There is no maneuver, something to stuck the pedal on it, and it goes with no maneuvering straight. And if it goes, if it was lucky to get to the Ukrainian site, then it was remotely exploded. So it's like World War One right now from Russian side. Back to you.
I have a one-word answer.
And that would be?
Yachts. Y-A-C-H-T-S.
And the translation of that acronym?
That's not an acronym. I'm talking about boats.
Oh, okay. Yachts.
Are you baffled?
Somewhat. I'm assuming that you're going to suggest that the Ukrainians go on yachts and blow up the hell out of the Russian Navy, but please tell me.
Are there any Russian oligarchs without multiple incredibly expensive yachts?
I think a number of them have been confiscated across the world, but I'm sure they still have more than enough in places around Russia.
Well, before all this started, you couldn't be a Russian oligarch without a few $1 billion worth of yachts. Am I correct?
It was $200 million. Mr. Putin had two of them. One was 763 million, and the other one was only 200 million, and they were just gifts from other oligarchs, and other oligarchs were just, I call them money deposit boxes. So when he was in need, he just said, you're going to give that much money to this and that much money to that. So, yeah, that was the story. But right now, the only what holds Ukrainian is minefields. Russian put hundreds of thousands of those minefields, and of course, Americans and other countries, they gave machinery to explode and remove those mines. But it's not easy when the enemy is shooting at them. And trick you.
Are you ready for my punchline, Roy?
Sure.
Where did the money come for all of those yachts? May I posit my theory?
Okay, I mean, basically, the oligarchs led all the resources. The Russia is the kind of the old story is it's a gas station with nukes, but in addition to a gas station, it also has massive deposits of all kinds of mineral, aluminum. You know, there's some idiot who's called the Aluminum King in Russia. He's made billions of dollars by excavating it and selling it to the world. So my guess would be minerals and such that are present underground in Mother Russia.
And how about this one? Gutting the Russian military by siphoning off the money to create a hollowed out corrupt system.
Well, yeah, I mean that's been an ongoing thing. I don't think it's the source of all the money, but it's the source of a lot of people's money, especially generals probably have yachts of their own, and they certainly have a couple of nice villages worth a few million dollars. So yeah, they've been hollowing out the Russian military for 20 plus years. That's why I'm a little curious of how many really useful nukes they have left. Nukes, as you well know, need to be maintained. That's expensive. You can spend millions of dollars refreshing a single missile. So I don't think they're spending millions of dollars refreshing missiles. I think they probably refresh maybe a dozen, and the rest of the money gets handed out to everyone.
So my statement about yachts isn't as stupid as you might have thought?
No, but yeah, I mean, unfortunately, they waste their money on all kinds of things. I mean, if you are ever interested in real estate in London, lots of luck. They have bought up all the real estate. They have bought up a lot of New York real estate. Real estate brokers in Manhattan love them because that's a way of them hiding all their money behind invisible deeds and such. So they have amassed a great deal of fortune in yachts, in real estate, in gold and diamonds and all manner of things. They're all... It's a kleptocracy. It's a government by thieves.
Agreed, but, you know, everybody needs some place to live. Obviously, you don't need that opulent a place to live. But nobody really needs a yacht. That's why I focus on the yachts. Conspicuous consumption, even more so, even more blatantly in your face than the others.
Okay, I mean, ultimately, if you look into these mansions, these people have, you know, 18 bathrooms, 36 bedrooms, and it's just two people living in them. So, you know, there's conspicuous consumption all over the place. I guess at least a mansion stay in one place, whereas yachts can annoy all manner of people all over the world where there's water or such. You know, good old Bezos. He had such a massive super yacht that he needs a smaller yacht to take care of his bigger yacht.
Well, you know the old adage, a boat is a hole in the water into which you pour all of your money, and it's open-ended. There is no upper limit.
Yes, I have heard that, and we have a few people listening tonight, hopefully, who have owned boats and have learned that lesson dearly. I understand it's sort of the same thing with planes as well.
Oh, absolutely. But it's a hole in the air into which you pour all your money.
Yes, indeed. I have never had the insanity or nor the money to really flush big-time things down the drain. For a time, I was deeply interested as a child in tropical fish, and I used to tell everyone that you can simulate the experience by taking your wallet into your bathroom and taking the bills and flinging them into the toilet and flushing. It gives you the same satisfaction.
I guess you're not still raising tropical fish.
No, it was a phase I went through. I enjoyed it. For some odd reason, strangeness attracts me, or is attracted by me or something. I've had aquarium fish that committed suicide on me, actively. They attempted it, it failed, and given, unfortunately, a second chance, they completed the act. So I've had suicidal aquarium fish.
Hey, Roy, I just noticed something. You wanted me to discuss something, and you're getting close. See, maybe I should take a minute to hit the loop first?
Certainly. Please, feel free. Anyway, while we're waiting for Ed to come back, if you have any questions or comments tonight, preferably short ones, because I you know, we're kind of running late tonight. I kind of... I added my own stuff at the beginning. I hope no one minds. But if you have something short, please hit that push to talk.
W2BZ.
Yes, Rich.
I don't know how short these are going to be. Well, one's going to be short. as you know, I was looking into desoldering a connector from a motherboard and replacing it with a new connector. And the way they do it on the internet, on YouTube, is even though I'm eventually taking this thing out, they add solder to the connecting points, and then they desolder it. Would you know why they add solder before taking off the solder?
Yes, I know exactly, and I think I sent it to you in an email, but I guess you haven't had a chance to look at it. The type of solder that's used mostly commercially is RHOS lead-free solder, because lead is considered toxic. So instead of nice 60-40 solder that melts at 363 degrees Fahrenheit, they offer you the lead-free variety that melts at 425. It's much easier to get your PC card at 363, and you're less likely to fry any of your nearby components than you would be if you had to blast it with 425 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's simply a means of replacing lead-free solder with 6040 lead solder, and allowing you to accomplish your desolder and resolder much more easily than using that miserable thing called lead-free solder.
But the lead-free solder is still there. You're just putting leaded solder on top of it.
And if it was all solid at the beginning, the middle, and the end, you would be quite right. But you're melting it, right? So what you're doing is the heat is and the lead is going to leach into the non-lead solder, and eventually it'll become an alloy with a lower melting point.
Okay, so it all has to do with lowering the melting point of the combined two solders.
Yes, and if you remember, a lot of those YouTubes, they precisely removed all the solder before they put a fresh bit of 6040 on. So although the melting point of what they were working with was probably higher than 363, it was not anywhere near the 425 it would have been if they did not dab that 6040 on there.
Okay, and the other thing is, I ordered, they all use solder that comes in a syringe. I think it's called flux paste or solder paste, versus the other type that comes in a little tub, which I guess is used more for cleaning. What's the difference between the two types of flux?
Okay, flux, the resin, there's different things. We remember most resins these days as resin cores, where the solder, the 6040 solder, would have a hollow core, and inside would be resin flux. But you don't have to have the two combined. You can have a tub or a tube or any kind of form. The resin can be solid or liquid, depending upon its the materials that make it up. What you're talking about, solder paste, is not just the resin. It is a powder version of the solder mixed with resin, and it's what's used for surface mount. The idea is that you apply the solder paste at each solder pad as best you can. Then you lower the component into place, and when you apply a reheating surface mount solder heat gun, it melts the solder paste and produces some capillary attraction between the contacts, and the component kind of repositions itself, if you're lucky, in the proper orientation, and you have a nice surface mount solder joint.
So that all has to do with hot air, right? It's not with a soldering iron.
Yes, the usual method used is with a hot air gun. There are other methods. For some people who don't want to buy a hot air gun, There are instructions for how you can put it inside your bread toaster, and if it has a good thermal control, you can raise the temperature just high enough to melt the solder. It's not enough to wreck your components. That's another method I see.
Well, hopefully I won't have to do it. We'll see if Microsoft will repair this Xbox. But they also have these strips of clear, well, they're not clear, they're amber plastic that you put over neighboring components to absorb the heat, I guess, from the hot air gun. Do you know what those strips are made of?
Yeah, they're high temperature insulators. I think they're called Capan, they're polyamides. They sell them at all kind of lengths. I have rolls of them that are a quarter of an inch, half an inch. I've used them as way back as when I was fixing laptops, cathode lights too. They're just a plastic made of high temperature insulating material, so they don't melt as fast as most other tapes that you can apply.
If I put just, let's say, you know, painter's tape, you know, that blue tape, if I put a few layers of that on the border of the contact that I'm trying to get off, would that absorb enough heat, do you think?
Depending upon the temperature, I think you're more likely to set a fire ablaze. Those things are basically paper.
Okay, I just delayed. Was anybody else in there?
Yeah, I have a comment.
Let me see the repeater. Okay, I just want to make sure that Rich heard what I had to say, that you probably would burn things, because the blue painter's tape is paper, so it has a, you know, it doesn't have a very high temperature that it spontaneously combusts. It's always nice to have some of that high temperature tape available. Like I said, I have numerous different thicknesses available I've used off and on when I needed them.
Okay, I got that. Over at the other station.
Yeah, my question was actually a comment. The suction device, the syringe, do you have a contact of your hot iron for the fraction of the second just to melt it, and, or if you have a hot air suction unit, you just suck it? So you don't have to use two different kinds of a soldering paste or soldering wire, although it helps. Did you try that?
Yeah, I could try that. I don't know why they don't use solder wick, why they have to use this hot air process. Do you know, Roy?
Yeah, because you're not going to be able to get all the solder away. Once you remove the components, it's rather easy to clean up all the extra solder. There are about four or five big blobs of it that are connecting the case with the PC board. So, you know, those things that suck up a little bit of solder are nice if there's nothing getting in the way, but you got lots of things getting in the way. So, I mean, you could, and then you got the problem of, okay, so you're heating things up. So you're moving from, your soldering iron is moving to about 18 different things in that place, because unlike a hot air blast, it could only heat the small surface area. So, I mean, theoretically, could you do it? It would probably take the better part of a day.
Yeah, and I'm sure I would fry neighboring components. All right. Well, like I said, hopefully I don't have to do it. We'll see if Microsoft will fix this Xbox in warranty. Second question, I'll ask if nobody else is out there with a ham radio question, I'll ask my second question. How's that, Roy?
Is it all right with you, Ed? Okay, it's still away, so hit me with it. By the way, fortunately, the how to surface mount components nearby the HDMI connector. So you have a little bit of wiggle room. It's not a great deal, but better than if there were a bunch of, you know,
Okay, he's sort of dropping out of the repeater. Second question is, I know we've been over this stuff before, but I still don't get it. An air variable capacitor. I know how it works mechanically. There are metal plates that mesh and unmesh. I get that part of it. What I don't get is actually what's happening electrically to change the capacitance. How does it work when plates mesh to, you know, increase the capacitance of the variable capacitor? I know with, you know, a fixed capacitor, you have two plates and some kind of material in between the two plates. I get that part, and they store and release electrical charges. But how does it work with just air? I know the air is a substrate, right? I get that point, too. But I just don't know how it works electrically.
Can I handle it?
Okay.
Okay. It's a square inch of area that is in between the plates. So you have a steady part of the plate, and you have one that is inserted mechanically inside. Now you take the amount of the area that is in the plate. And if you think about air is dielectric, so there is no other things between them. There were, 20 years ago, capacitors that were variable, and they were called trimmers. They had the mica inside. But if you're talking about air-based capacitor, it doesn't have anything in between. So those two sections, one that is moving and one that is steady, are isolated from itself. And you have a capacitor. And the capacitor is just two plates and dielectric. So if you take any plate, put the same plate at the bottom of it, and keep the space, now you have a capacitor. And to exchange.
WB2EAB.
Ah, welcome back, Ed. We're just talking about variable capacitors. Let me put my two cents in. A capacitor is based upon the cross-section area of the two plates that are opposing each other, the dielectric constant of whatever is between the two plates facing each other, and the distance between the two plates. So if you were to squeeze the two plates closer together, you would increase the capacitance. If you were to increase the common cross-sectional area between the two plates, as you do with a variable capacitor, you would increase the capacitance. It's not really necessary to have a proper dielectric material, as you'll notice if you've ever read up on vacuum capacitors that exist in a vacuum. So the vacuum is the dielectric for the sake of the capacitor. But what's happening with a variable capacitor is you are changing the surface cross-section of the two plates opposing each other. And if you increase them, you increase the capacitance of that variable capacitor. And by unmeshing them, you decrease the cross-section of the plates that are across from each other, and you decrease the capacitor. How's that?
That, I don't know, that part I know. I know that it increases capacitance or it decreases capacitance, but I guess in a physics way, what's happening?
Again, it's a function of the charge on the capacitors, and the reason it's taking a charge is because there's an opposing charge on the other plate. If the two plates are aligned with each other, that's where you're getting the most charge and the most capacitance. If you take the two plates and you offset them so that none of the two plates are opposed to each other, then you effectively get a near zero capacitance. It's just It's just that idea taken to its ultimate extreme. And by meshing the variable capacitor plates against each other in line, you are increasing the charge carrying capacity of the capacitors, which is the capacitor.
WB280,
comment. Certainly, Ed.
By the way, I was only on for a little bit, and I don't have my radio, but for several minutes I was frantically trying to get in and get nowhere. And I have comments back on the soldering thing, but let me answer this one. Any capacitor stores energy in an electrostatic field between the plates. Given if the plates, like an air variable, are at a constant separation with always the same dielectric, as you increase the surface area of the two plates, there's more room for to store energy in this electrostatic field.
That's what I was looking for. So it's the electrostatic field that is increasing and decreasing in size. Is that right? Is that the right way to put it?
Absolutely. And let me add another point. Hang on. An inductor stores the energy in the magnetic field, and the two of them are analogous. Capacitor stores energy in the electrostatic field between the plates. An inductor stores the energy in a magnetic field through the center of the coil. And they're kind of analogous to each other.
Okay, now I don't understand on a fundamental level. I know what makes up a capacitor, let's say a fixed capacitor. I know the components of a fixed capacitor, but maybe I don't understand this electromagnetic field that's created between the two plates and how that stores energy and then releases that energy.
Well, first of all, it's not electromagnetic. It's electrostatic. It's only a voltage field. And now you're really getting into basic raw physics.
And that's where I thought it would go, into the physics end of it. But I guess I just have to take it on faith that they work.
No, they don't work, and that's why we're not talking to each other over radio. It depends on this principle.
For some reason, resistors are much easier to understand than capacitors. For me, anyway.
Why? Where do inductors fit?
Well, a resistor is just material that eats up heat. Basically, isn't that the way resistors work?
No, my point is, if resistors are easy to understand, the capacitors are hard to understand, where do inductors fit on this scale?
For some reason, inductors are a little easier for me to understand. Because I misspoke before. You know, with inductors, it is the magnetic field that's created around the inductor. So I understand that. I guess it's the electromagnetic, it's the electric, now I'm twisting my thoughts. It's the other type of field that I don't quite grasp.
Yeah, well, if you're having no problem understanding the magnetic field around an inductor, it's very analogous to that. Now you're getting into the most fundamental areas of physics of how to establish an electrostatic field.
And that's what I'm actually after, that electrostatic field. What are the components of an electrostatic field? That's where I'm drilling or trying to drill down to.
There are no components that exist in a vacuum, as in a vacuum variable capacitor.
Repeat that, somebody stepped on it.
There are no components needed for an electrostatic field. In a vacuum variable capacitor, you are storing energy in an electrostatic field in a vacuum. There's nothing there, but it still happens.
What about electron?
Not in the true vacuum.
The plates don't have any charges on them by an electron?
I agree with you, Roy, but he's asking about the space between the plates.
Okay, are you asking about the space between the plates, or are you talking about the whole capacitor? Those are two different answers.
Really, I'm talking about the whole capacitor, not just what's between them. But maybe Ed was trying to explain it on a different level by saying that there can be an electric charge in a vacuum with nothing between them.
In a word, yes. But as Roy said, what's happening is you're collecting charge on the plate. But you could look at it that way. You're putting charge into the plate.
Yeah, there's a difference between charge from charged particles. Let me make sure I'm talking here. Okay, there's a difference between charged particles. Charged particles are electrons. On the negative end of a charge capacitor, you have net more electrons than a proton. So you have a net negative charge. On the opposing plate, it is charged in the opposite way. So it has less electrons than it has protons in the conducting plate. In the gap between it is simply a electric field produced by the charges on both sides of each plate. So the field itself doesn't need any medium. It can exist in a vacuum. Now, that's the problem that 19th century physicists had, that they were always looking for the ether. The ether doesn't exist. The fields don't require anything. They can occur in a vacuum.
So are you saying with a variable capacitor, by closing it, you're actually enabling more electron plate? Is that by closing it and then opening it, less electrons to be on each plate?
Yes. I would prefer calling it meshing it or enmeshing it rather than closing it, because it's more ambivalent closing it. But yes, and it's not that both plates have more electrons. One plate has more electrons, one plate has less electrons. They're oppositely charged.
Okay, but again, meshing it allows for more positive and negative electrons to be present?
Yes, it allows for more charged particles to store themselves up on the opposing plates that are now enmeshed with each other and opposed to each other in physical space, as opposed to being offset someplace else between the two.
And that's the answer I've been looking for. Now I understand. That's exactly what I've been looking for. Finally, Ed, by the way, on YouTube, search for Jimmy's World. Jimmy's World. He's a pilot, and he's a very fun guy. You'll have a great time watching his videos. Jimmy's World on YouTube. All right, now I got my answer. Roy, back to you, and we'll listen out.
Old business.
Yeah, Ed, do you have anything else you want to say before we get on to your topic for tonight?
Yeah, what I was trying to say when I was having, I don't know, my radio, something was on my radio. If you are looking to solder or unsolder stuff on a printed circuit board, I will tell you, if the pin spacing is 50,000, about 1 1/4 millimeters or more, the classic stuff applies, but I would recommend using a soldering iron with a very thin point. Below 50,000 or 1 1/4 millimeter spacing, forget about it. Forget about it. Unless you really, really know what you're doing, you're only going to mess things up.
I know. That's what I was afraid of. You know, if Microsoft won't fix it, I'll have no... I got quotes, you know, $150, somebody quoted me $250, That was just to replace an HDMI port. The thing costs $250. I'm not going to spend $250 to get a port replaced. So I was I studied about five or more videos, and you really have to have control of that heat on the air gun or whatever they call it in soldering. You really have to control that because you could mess up and overheat the board itself. So it is very, very delicate. And they just apply a ton of flux. They keep on applying flux. Every, 3 seconds they're applying more flux. So I guess that loosens things up quite a bit.
And I will guarantee the first time you try it yourself is going to be a disaster. The question is, how many failures will you have before you get the hang of it?
I know. Where's Andy when we need him, huh?
Well, on that sad note, thank you, Rich. Ed, I was fascinated. I read some articles that I thought of you. So if you would like to do a little presentation on this topic, I would enjoy it immensely.
Are you going to lead into it, or do you want me to start?
Well, I mentioned earlier that the New York Times had done a very interesting article on near-miss accidents in the airplane industry. Websites have done articles based on it with very weird replies where people keep on mentioning that car accidents are much more common, which they are. But, you know, if a car has an accident, a couple people might die. If a plane has an accident, 100 people could die. And although we aren't in a position, I think, of actually having a lot of accidents, we are precariously close to on the cusp of something. There are measures that have been released, lessened cheaply in the air industry. So Ed has expertise in this subject and interest in this subject, so that's why I thought that Ed would be a perfect person to discuss this.
Okay, yeah, well, these articles are saying that a lot of people in the aviation industry are getting worried by the number of near-miss episodes. And yes, it is very definite, it is real, and they are worried that one of these days the near-miss is going to become a hit, and it's going to be a disaster, and nobody is prepared for that emotionally. Although some people are trying to see what they can do about it, but they feel that there really aren't any quick answers. And I have been idly following some of these discussions for a while. And basically, there are two issues. One is air traffic controllers, and the other is pilots. Now, you have to realize first, commercial aviation, nobody, no pilot, flies the plane by the seat of his pants. Everything they do is at the direction of air traffic control. Everything. They virtually never take the initiative. They may take a specific initiative in a very, very narrow thing. But as a general rule, unless there's an absolute emergency, the air traffic control tells them exactly where to go, when to do it, and how to do it. And you can understand why the radio communication that they use for this is critically important. And I have a personal observation. You can listen to stuff now on the internet of air traffic control channels. And I believe a lot of people are not giving it these communications, the attention with proper enunciation. I find a lot of people are speaking too quickly and slurring their words. And I personally see that could lead to a lot of misunderstood directions. But coming back into what I've read in the press and all this, one thing that a lot of people are not aware of is air traffic controllers are horribly overworked now. First of all, everybody assumes the air traffic control system is basically perfect, and nobody guarantees adequate funding. In decades, there's been a problem with funding for FAA and air traffic control and all that, and then COVID came in, which disrupted the whole system. You know, when air traffic plummeted, they didn't need all the people they had, so some of them were let go, and some of them went elsewhere, some of them retired, and when things started to pick up again, they had lost the number that they had beforehand. And the bottom line is, right now, air traffic controllers are overworked, and an overworked air traffic controller is a formula for disaster. I'm going to drop it. Part number two is the pilots. A lot of the pilots are making mistakes. There are a number of reasons for that. Like, for example, there's a lot of problems with planes being told to hold at such and such a position, and they overshoot it, sometimes getting too close to planes passing by on an active runway. And a lot of the near misses are on the ground, where a plane just doesn't stop quite where it's supposed to. And a large part of that is experience, but there's a problem, again, with COVID. When the bottom fell out of civil aviation, a lot of pilots were furloughed or whatever. Some of them went elsewhere. Some of them retired. And here's the problem. You can't switch them back on again. It takes years to train pilots. It takes years to train air traffic controllers, so there's no quick turnaround. So that is where this is coming from. Let me let it drop. Now, there are a number of YouTube regulars who have discussed this sort of stuff, and one of them is a kind of an iconoclastic zealot. There are people who love him, and there are people who hate him. His name is Dan Ryder, and he goes on to Dan Ryder. He calls his little show Probable Cause. It's on YouTube. And he occasionally looks into the camera and says, the reason I'm here is I want you to stop killing yourselves in your airplanes. And he goes over various airplane accidents and things, and he's pushing for something for general aviation that the airline started using called A2P, which is constant training for emergencies. Let me drop it. A large part of problems are, as Dan Ryder says, in order to get a pilot's license and all of the certifications, you do a canned set of things. And they don't really have to emphasize on being prepared for emergencies. Now, if you are a student pilot, you're flying along with the instructor. You'll be flying along, and all of a sudden he pushes the throttle to idle and says, simulated engine failure. And then you have to retrim the plane, glide. Then you tell him where the nearest airports are and whether you can glide there. And then, if there isn't one, you start showing him where good soft spots might be to put the plane down. So this is the kind of thing, and of course you can get much more sophisticated than that. Let me drop. So there's a large element of training for emergencies. Go off topic, nuclear power plants. After Three Mile Island happened, they realized people were not being, nuclear plant operators were not being trained in how to recognize problems and know what to do instinctively. And since then, every nuclear power plant has a second control room, which is solely for training purposes. And it's the same thing now. Pilots are now spending large amounts of time in simulators where they throw all kinds of nonsense at them. Let me let it drop. And this dang writer has mentioned there's another aspect. The last state, you know, United States airplane crash was in Buffalo, New York about 15 years ago with Colgan Airlines, which is a small airline that has contracts with the larger airlines, and a plane crashed. And the analysis showed that the pilots, the co-pilot, had not really been trained in emergency procedures, and they made some mistakes. And a lot was learned for that. A lot of what I just said came out of that Colgan Airlines crash, where they realized we have to train our pilots to instinctively respond. Let me try. Now, one thing that's adding to the pilot shortage that came out of this, even though both the pilot and co-pilot had more than 1,600 hours of flight time, for some reason, Congress changed the law that airlines cannot hire a co-pilot with less than 15 hours of experience. And apparently, this has driven away a lot of people who wanted to become a pilot. Because the point is, there's a fairly large gap between the number of hours it takes to become nominally qualified and the number of hours it takes to make the 1,600 hours, and that turns a lot of people off, so the pilot shortage has gotten even worse. And then you have a problem. When you have the shortage,
they drop the requirement. High school diploma, you don't even need to get it. They drop the college and high school.
Well, there are very specific requirements for what are required, but the point is, when there are shortages in such a critical industry, you're going to find yourself having problems. And again, it takes a long time to train pilots. A lot of airlines now are actually laying out money for pilot training programs, but it still takes a long time to propagate through. Roy, have I addressed the problem?
AC2GS, yes, you have, Ed, and I thank you very much. You made it concise and understandable. It's a shortage issue, and I hope people don't wait until they are left with no choices or when something terrible happens. That's usually the way human beings tend to work. I hope it works differently this time.
Did I drive everybody away?
I don't think so, Ed. They're still there. Maybe they're sipping on their drinks.
This is KB2FYH with a question not related to what was being talked about.
Sure, FYH.
Yes. When it comes to capacitance, inductance and incapacitance, I'm trying to think it in a very simple way. An alternating current, high alternating current fed into a secondary coil, and it goes into a capacitor, and the induction coil is turned off, and the capacitor stores that electricity, that current. Is that when it was discharged? Would it be an alternating current or a direct current? Over.
I'm confused. Roy?
Well, pencil me in as well. You want to say that one more time?
Yes. I'm self-taught when it comes to electronics. Let's just say a capacitor is charged. It's charged by an induction coil. An induction coil, an alternating current that's fed into the capacitor. When the induction coil is turned off and the capacitor is storing the current, and if it is discharged, that capacitor, how does it discharge the current? Is it an alternating current or a direct current? Over.
I think I may have an answer.
Okay, Ed, please try your best. I'm assuming that this is a capacitor that's being alternately charged with a positive and negative on the plates, and so when they discharge things, they're inherently discharging in an alternate manner. But Ed, if you have it better thought out, please enlighten me.